Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone. We are waiting for we're waiting for Kevin Jones to join us. He's our host today. He's probably changing from his Clark Kent outfit into his putting on his cape, and I see him about to hop on here. Nothing like a few technicalities. So I'll just introduce myself while we wait for him to do the rest of the introductions. I am Gail Kellner, and I'm happy to be here today. And I'll just go with Kevin's introduction. I'd like to recognize Lynn Kerrigan, poet par excellence, relocated from the land of magnolias to the island of madrones, our analytic academic, social worker, backup singer, musician, activist, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes. And there's Kevin. I see him on the Zoom screen, and I shall turn it over to him. Kevin, I've introduced myself and Lynn.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's an unexplainable phenomenon of the universe, and my apologies for being delayed. But it's great to have a chance to join everybody today. And I assume that we mentioned that it is now March 2nd on a Tuesday, and we wanted, of course, to thank Brian Brown, our founder, for that wonderful introduction. I also want to say that we also, of course, have island historian, storyteller, international educator, and accomplished skipper Bruce Hallman joining us today, our stalwart guardian of the galaxy. Good morning, Bruce.
Good to be here.
Likewise. And a shift change today, temporarily joined today by briefly emeritus Susan McCabe in the Voice of Vachon studio, while who needs autopilot airline captain Truman O'Brien is off on a mission of higher calling. Susan, I'm so glad you could join us today.
Yeah, I'm apparently the autopilot. And I'm delighted to be here with you guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Susan.
I hope you'll dampen out the turbulence and make sure that we are heading in the right direction.
I will do my best.
Let's hope this is not a Boeing 737 that autopilot takes over and drives us into the ground, at least, right?
I'm getting nervous about any Boeings, but yeah.
We're trusting.
Now and then our debris does come raining down on people.
Now and then one of us blows up and catches on fire. One of the engines. Yeah.
Okay, well, if we see disaster pending, the words are pull up, pull up, pull up. It's important thing. Okay, that little bit that I do know. As you've been wondering where the heck I've been, yours truly, editor of Indivisible Vachon's weekly publication for your consideration, Kevin Jones. I'm happy to be hosting, even though belatedly today. By the way, those who want to expand your climate awareness, tune into the Progressive Vachon podcast right here on Voice of Vachon tonight at 9 p.m. to hear what three climate activists are doing through the Washington State Legislature to keep climate change at bay. Leaders from FutureWise, the Climate Alliance for Jobs and Clean Energy, and the Washington Environmental Council are going to share their legislative agendas with Indivisible Washington podcast host Stephen Cox. So join in tonight on Voice of Vachon at 9 o'clock if you'd like to join in. And Susan, are there any other announcements that we might want to make? Real Talk, perhaps?
Real Talk is coming on at noon, and I'm having one of my favorite return guests, Brian Check, who is from the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy. And he has found a silver lining in the COVID pandemic that is economic. And he is really all about a conservation economy, which kind of fits in with your climate action topic. So 12 noon, Brian Check, very interesting guy.
All right.
I look forward to that.
I'd like to announce that the Heritage Museum is starting a new program called History Worth Hearing that will premiere this Friday afternoon at, I believe, 3 p.m. It'll be broadcast again the following week. But Chris Austin, board member of the museum, historian, humorist, is going to sort of bring topics of Vashon's history and Vashon's heritage to the community in interviews with curators of exhibits, with collections people from the museum. It should be an interesting half hour, 45 minutes or so of Vashon heritage. So that will premiere this Friday on Voice of Vashon, 3 p.m.
That's
history
exciting.
Worth hearing.
Yeah, oh, lovely.
Awesome. So don't forget, folks, you heard it first here on Voice of Vashon. So, all right. Hey, so this is sort of a focus on Where Goes Our Democracy edition of the Brown Briefly. there's a lot of discussion in the news media today. If you were captivated like I was with FBI Director Wray's testimony to a congressional committee about the insurrection on January 6th, there's a lot of moving pieces to what's been going on lately in our country in regards specifically to the state of our democracy. So in addition to things like the CPAC, can also happen over this weekend, the Congressional something or another, or the, I'm sorry, the Conservative Political Action Committee, I think.
Yep, conservative, yeah.
Yes, which they, yeah. Some are claiming it should be TPAC for the former president. And the gold-plated Trump figure that was sort of center attraction there. And the statement that, no, we're all going to rally around the Republican Party. And so it looks like the at least the Trump portion of the party has a goal in mind. We also have the COVID relief activity where there was actually, the it was touted usually as the $1.9 trillion bill introduced by the administration. That relief package did pass in the House with bipartisan opposition. All the Republicans and two Democrats in the House voted no for COVID relief for the country. And the $15 an hour minimum wage is on the chopping block in the Senate. So I'm, you know, looking at our democracy and the fact we have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. What kind of indicators are we seeing about how it's doing? And where's our democracy headed?
Any where are the people? I don't see the people in this activity. When 60 to 70% of the people are for the COVID Relief Act and 60 to 70% of the people are for a $15 minimum wage, where the heck are the legislators who are supposedly representing the people?
Mm-hmm.
The good question,
yeah. That question goes to the structure of the American democratic system, you know, the Republican system, republic that we have, and the sort of setup of the Senate and the House and the allocation of seats to the states, the sort of traditional, you know, division between state and federal rights. And it has always been, you know, sort of weighted toward a minority, a rich, white, male minority. And that is not who we are as a country any longer, although lots of people would like to think it is. And so we have some deep structural issues to deal with. Beyond just the politics of getting legislation through. And to me, I mean, one of the most telling things was Bill Kristol, who is not, you know, a raging liberal, even a raging moderate by any means. I mean, he's a very, very dedicated conservative. He is very worried in his last sort of opinion piece in the New York Times, very worried about the future of our democratic system. Because when you begin to question the validity of voting, you begin to question what you brought up, Susan, where are the people? Mm-hmm. If people don't have a voice, the only people who have a voice are the leaders, and the leaders who are not chosen by the people. And that's the dilemma that we're confronting right now.
And what do we call that kind of system? Is that authoritarian? Is that fascism? Is that an oligarchy? What is that called?
Well, from my perspective, I mean, it's I mean, fascism is a kind of authoritarianism. You know, there's multiple kinds of it, but it's authoritarianism. It's putting authority in one individual or one small group. So it's a kind of authoritarianism. It has elements of fascism, certainly, and it has elements of other kinds of sort of far right, you know, isms in it. But essentially, it's the rule of one small group. We saw that for nearly 100 years in the South, where blacks, women were basically disenfranchised. You know, any minority groups had no voice. And it was a small cabal of white males who ran the Southern states and essentially ran them into the ground. That's why they're the poorest states in the nation. That's why they have the worst school systems in the nation, you know. And anytime you put the hands of power in a few people who don't answer to people, you have an authoritarian regime. So that's my fear.
And yeah. Gail had some comments, and then follow that by Lynn. Go ahead, Gail.
I was just going to say, I might call it a corporatocracy, because yeah. I think that that's, I don't know if that's an actual term. It's a term I coined to describe when you have corporate America, a big oil, big gas, the large companies from pharmaceuticals to insurance companies really running the show and controlling the legislation that passes then gets in. And in many ways, it's a system. I don't have the coined the term for it yet, but it's a system where that's simply run by who has the most money.
Yeah. Lynn.
Yeah, I agree with that, Gail. And, part of my comment wanted to weave that idea about the $15 minimum wage into this discussion. I was reading an article in January 18th, New Yorker, by Jill Lepore, one of my favorite historians, who was writing about work and endless work and how our home lives are now being taken over by email everywhere all the time and a failing kind of gig economy that essentially disenfranchises people from much say in the corporations they work on. And, you know, unions have been busted. And the point that I want to make that she made, she said, well, so where is all the money? You know, if the stock market is doing well and corporations and the GDP, the gross domestic product, are doing really well, where is the money? And she says it's all gone to chief executives. That in 1965, the CEO compensation was about 20 times that of the average worker. By 2015, it was more than 200 times that. And it's mentioning the CEO of Dunkin' Brands, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, all of that, took in $5.4 million in compensation. And he called the proposed $15 an hour minimum wage absolutely outrageous. So I think that people are being kind of pushed aside for corporate profits and the money flowing upwards rather than, you know, with rights and money flowing mm-hmm. to the people. So I think we are in trouble as a democracy, if by that you consider a democracy of, by, and for the people.
Yeah. Gail, what do you think?
I'm very interested in this topic of a $15 minimum wage. I'd like to see any one of those legislators who voted against it live for a month, even on $15 an hour, and see what that felt like. Let alone half of that amount, you know, which is many state, which right now is the federal minimum wage is just a little over $7 an hour. And I also was really interested in things like Walmart, who has been against setting a $15 minimum wage. And they, I read something from Bernie Sanders recently that their family wealth represents more than something like 20 or 40% of the bottom wealth of the entire country. So on one hand, you have this family that is outlandishly wealthy, and you have this family that also is against paying minimum wage to their workers. And I think that there's this, again, this worship of money. And I think that that's, I think that number 45, as I called the former, whatever presidential position he had. He was about the worship of money, and it's a cult of money that is being worshipped.
Yeah, Susan.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Gail. And I think it's a symptom, and I think the 45th was a symptom, sort of the pustule on the end of the pimple that has been the philosophy of capitalism gone awry in this country. And I wonder, what is the tipping point? At what point is it going to be so severe, the gap between the Walmarts of the world and wall people, and the rest of us? When is that going to be just intolerable? And it's bad business. I mean, you know, if you don't pay people a living wage, they're not going to shop at Walmart anymore. They can't afford to buy anything. Come on, people. How much money do you need?
Yeah, I think Lynn has a comment on that.
Well, yeah, Susan, I really agree with that, too. And, it makes me feel like we are at the tipping point. And from my perspective, a lot of the disorder in our society we're seeing right now is directly related to that disparity in wealth. And Thomas Piketty, who's the French guy who wrote Capital in the 21st Century, proved, it's a very dense book, but, he researched and proved that we're back at robber baron stages of the 1890s through the 1920s, when, the corporate development certainly was innovative, but it was also extremely had wealth disparity, separating the common man from all of these rich guys. And I think that, we are seeing not just the kind of a strange presidency as a symptom, but a lot of the insurrection comes from alienation and people feeling the government doesn't represent them anymore and they don't have much of a stake in things. Kevin.
Kind of leads us to this interesting position where, don't the Republicans think that their constituents want COVID relief, right? There's how do we explain this? We know that we have, the politics is now resorted to us against them kind of model, depending on which side of the, based on the two sides of the aisle you're on. So is this a political stunt in terms of sort of advantage by the Republicans? How do we think we can explain the fact that so many Republican constituents are clearly in need, like the rest of the country, but they're not willing to support this? Any thoughts?
I know Bruce, you're muted. Are you ready? Go ahead, Bruce, and then I'll add something.
Yeah, I think it's instructive to look back at the last two times that America has been in this situation. One in the 1840s and 1850s, and it resulted in a civil war. And again in the 1880s and 1890s, that resulted in the progressive movement. But it really took, the civil war and what pulled us out of the sort of kleptocracy of the Golden Age was the Great Depression. And I really think what you're seeing right now is the pandemic is having the same kind of effect in political ramifications, just like the Great Depression did, just like the Civil War did. And what you're seeing is the same kind of thing that you're seeing, that you saw in the 1870s and 1880s, when Reconstruction was overturned by a kleptocracy, if you will, to sort of suppress the vote, to suppress, a democratic society. And the same thing that you saw, in the beginning in the 1950s, began reacting against the New Deal and the sort of broadening of the American social system under the New Deal to where we are today. So it's clear to me that, Republicans are grasping at straws. They've already lost, and so they're trying to sort of maintain what little power they have for as long as they have. But it's going to be swept away, and the pandemic is going to be the force that sort of sweeps it away.
Yeah, Gail, your thoughts.
Yeah, I just wanted to reflect that I agree with that. I think we are at that breaking point for a number of reasons. It's nice to look back at history. You know, $15 an hour was brought up. I believe it was first in Seattle that was first raised. I could be wrong about that. That was several years ago, and now it's at the federal level of consciousness. Many people who would have and did vote for number 45 to be number 46 definitely would benefit from a $15 an hour minimum wage. And I think that the other thing that I think is important to realize is that it's Blacks, many people of color, and women who would benefit from a $15 minimum wage. And I'm not sure that all Republicans, and this is my little attempt to reach across the aisle here, are against it completely, but maybe would like to see it phased in, or would like to see it relative to other economic factors in their states. But I pass it to Lynn.
You know, that may be true, and I agree that there are Republicans out there like Jamie Herrera Butler who are new to politics and really still standing for principles, as opposed to some of the entrenched leadership in the Senate in particular, where the Republican Party, in my opinion, is sort of gone slightly mad because they've lost, you know, control of not only the presidency, but, you know, lost Senate seats. And I feel like their main priority now is to regain power at any cost. And that they have dug themselves a hole, because sometimes they equate sharing money like that, you know, giving more money to the line workers, as socialism. And so now they're in a hole of their own making, where some of the very things that would gain them more support, perhaps, if they, you know, went along with it, is something ideologically they disagree with. It's sad to me.
Gail, did you have another comment?
Yeah, I actually have a question for Bruce, if he could maybe share a bit on a couple of topics, but I wanted to start on this one. You know, I was thinking about democracy as you posed our question for the show today, the state of our democracy. And I came across in the last few weeks an interesting thing, Australians Citizens Parliament. Bruce, you're familiar with that, I'm sure, with your connections there. And you could speak to it more eloquently than I can, but I will just briefly say it was randomly selected group of citizens that were brought together to begin to put together basically a new constitution. And it went a long ways. It's easy for us to think that democracy, that we somehow in 1776 hit the pinnacle. And I just like to have to laugh about that, because we haven't. There, you know, anyone who's curious about this, dive deep. There's fascinating things and new ideas out there about what democracy can look like. So, Bruce, can you talk a little bit about Australians' experiment with the Citizens' Parliament?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it was an interesting movement, and it came up with some really valid suggestions about how to change democracy in Australia. It didn't go very far, because it ran into the same kind of thing that we will run into when we try and rewrite our constitution. It's sort of like, who has the power to make the final decision? And right now, the constitution can be amended, but the amendment process is a process that's fraught with, you know, difficulties. And so my sense is, yeah, it's great to have that kind of approach and to get a variety of ideas on the table. But how do you actually bring them to fruition? How do you bring them into reality? And that's what Australia stumbled over. That's what we've been stumbling over. Because, you know, our 36 states, which it takes to amend the Constitution, going to agree to something that's potentially going to reduce their influence in national politics? That's the real question.
Mm-hmm. Susan, you had a comment.
You know, I think in the United States, we have tried to do that with amendments to the Constitution, as you mentioned, Bruce. And there's a great series on Netflix called Amend, and it's all about the 14th Amendment. And they claim, and they substantiate that claim, that the 14th Amendment is when the United States really started to become the promise that it had in the origins of the Constitution. We've yet to really fulfill the promise of even the 14th Amendment, but that is the amendment that said everybody born in the United States is equal. Mm-hmm. And that gives us the grounding for maybe realizing the promise of American plurality, of American inclusion. But there's still a whole lot of work ahead because of the power struggle of money over human value, essentially. Kevin.
Yeah, that kind of brings us back to this question of representation, right? That was just shown so clearly in this COVID vote in the House. Susan, earlier you asked the question, you know, what do we call this? This apparent lack of representation. And The Economist, their intelligence report, gives us four options in their assessment of what types of democracies they evaluate: a full democracy, a flawed democracy, a hybrid regime, and an authoritarian regime. Curious where you think The Economist put us on that scale.
It'd be cheating for me because I happen to read some of that. So
okay.
I'm going to pause and just wait.
Me too. I read it as well.
Okay. So I think we probably know that we're now a flawed democracy. And if others read it, they probably know where they ranked the U.S., you know, the top 10, top 20, top 30. Anybody know where we stand?
I don't recall that detail.
Gail has got a big smile on her face, though.
Because I don't think it's very pretty low.
So they, you know, they looked at 167 countries. All right, so it's a big pool, and they put the U.S. as number 25. And so there's a couple of things in sort of noodling through what are we seeing and what does this assessment tell us. So one of the things that they report is that. They said the U.S. remains in the flawed democracy category, having fallen out of the full democracy category in 2016. It's kind of an interesting date. What could possibly have happened in 2016 that would have caused that?
Oh, duh.
Okay. I think there was that's when the 44th president turned over the reins to the 45th. Am I right? Yeah, Lynn, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I think that's right. And yet, you know, I'll just say the part that I really remember about why the U.S. was ranked so low had to do with more recent events, had to do with the contested election of 2020. And it had to do with violent insurrection in our country against our government based on, you know, the questions about the election, which, you know, are all disproven, and people refuse to believe it to this minute. So, boy, I'd say at least flawed, if not headed towards something worse.
Well, and it's interesting because The Economist gets into that, but let's talk about the good news first, because they charted out what are some of the elements of this. So we're gonna come back to what you just said. But the good news is The Economist reports that U.S. political engagement and participation increased in the last 5 years. Said the most significant improvements were in political engagement and political participation, now at its highest level since 2006. Americans have become much more engaged in politics in recent years. Two-thirds of us are either very or somewhat interested in politics, and over half of us search for politics news in social or traditional media. Yeah, is this a good sign or a bad sign, or what do we make of that?
Well, I think to some degree, it is a sign of the conflict that we're in. Unfortunately and fortunately at the same time, many people have gotten out and voted. People have come to understand the importance of participatory democracy. But at the same time, I think it's out of a lot of anxiety and a lot of concern about what happened in 2016. Mm-hmm. I'm probably stating the obvious there.
There is a great motivator there. Lynn, what are your thoughts?
I've enjoyed watching, you know, different groups demonstrating for their point of view and demanding sort of seats at the table. You know, I think that element of political engagement is a good thing, but we're not working very hard to try to figure out how to deal with these various factions and the fracturing of our country. And I'm going to just, this is my quote of the day, and it's from Mahatma Gandhi, who said, peace is not the absence of conflict, it's the ability to cope with it. And so, you know, I think that it is wonderful that we have all these disparate demonstrations, but at some point we have to get behind some sort of a platform toward a better union. And that's where I think we're stalled a little bit.
Yeah. So, Bruce, a question for you is, so this increase in, marked increase in political engagement, you know, you mentioned a couple of historical inflection points where, you know, the country has charted a new course through some adversity. Do you know if we saw that same increase in political engagement as a precedent to those events as well?
That's interesting. I've not thought of that. I don't know. You know, certainly the Civil War resulted in a huge increase in participation, particularly in the South, you know, as slaves were freed. And you know, during Reconstruction, you know, Black legislators, Black senators and representatives in Congress, you know, governors, I mean, you know, it was a mass increase in participation as a result. And of course, because of that comes Jim Crow and the suppression in 100 years until Brown versus the Board of Education begins to sort of begin to remove those restrictions. You know, there was a fairly large increase in the Progressive Era of participation, just because, again, workers and immigrants who fueled that, and farmers, you got to remember, farmers were a big part of that progressive movement in the late 19th, early 20th century, were engaged. But what we see today, I think, is and you guys have all mentioned it, it's the divisions that have in sort of increased the participation, and it's the what's at stake. And so what you get is identity politics, which is often used as a negative term by the right, but essentially, you know, right-wing conservatives have developed an identity politics that's trying to return to a kind of America they see in the late 19th, early 20th century, in the 1950s, where women knew their place, African Americans knew their place. There were not all these immigrant groups coming in, and you know, America was a white bread society. You know, the left also has an identity politics, but it's fractured, and that's always been the problem with the Democratic Party. Is, you know, it's a big tent, but it's got a lot of contending factions within the tent. That's going to be the future of politics. And that's why I think we're seeing participation up so much, because the stakes are so high.
Mm-hmm. And Susan, you may have had a comment. Otherwise, I think Lynn did.
Yeah, it's about the intensity. I think people are participating more because they feel threatened. They feel that their lifestyle is threatened, and that their power is threatened. And we all know that when change comes on the horizon, the status quo gets more intense. And therefore, then the conflict will be more intense. I'm not sure what kind of future we're looking at, but clearly the plurality and the complexity of our society has been growing. And hey, white folks, you are in the minority now, if we look at it. And I think that's pretty scary for a lot of people.
Yes, Gail.
I'm really interested that the energy and efforts that went into not only electing Biden and Kamala Harris as the vice president, but then into the Senate to bring in two Democratic senators in Georgia in particular, that were the turning point for getting control of the Senate. And now we seem to be falling back on archaic rules that that seems so very undemocratic to me. Can one of you in the know explain to me how these rules can be held up and maintained to allow a Republican minority, apparently, to do so much damage and stand in the way of so much progress that so many people want and voted for?
Referring to the parliamentarian, I assume, and maybe Bruce has a comment.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the way our legislative system was structured. I mean, you know, the House was to represent the people, the Senate was to represent the states. That's the Great Compromise. You know, and all of the rules are designed to slow things down. You got to remember, this political system was developed at a time when it took 3 days to get a letter from New York to Boston, and so everything was structured to not move too quickly. And of course, in the age we live today of instantaneous communications, I mean, I can text you and 2 minutes later hear from my friend in Australia. It's a different world. And do we want to restructure those, sort of rules and procedures to reflect the new world? I mean, the filibuster is a perfect example of that. And at some point, the filibuster, from my perspective, needs to be eliminated. Filibuster allows a small minority to essentially stop the movement of the majority, which is anti-democratic.
Lynn, you've got a comment.
Yeah, it seems like there's something else, though, that is built into our Constitution, where from a kind of an old Adam Smith perspective, the Constitution says that part of the government's job is to protect the wealth of nations, not only the part about all people being equal and of, by, and for the people, but, if one group has all the money, then you're kind of protecting a certain class of people's wealth. It comes down to, who has the money and who's willing to share it and who's not. If the social democracy is supposed to kind of counter a little bit capitalism, how do we heal that big fracture? How do we be more reasoned and more aware of having a functioning democracy with your people actually having enough money to live? I mean, really.
Just yes, one real quick comment. I mean, the framers of the Constitution were not poor people.
That's right.
They structured a government that would maintain their power, their wealth, their authority. I mean, it's amazing democracy, but you got to look back at the origins.
Yes, I do want to also add, Gail, to the question you brought up about adhering to the recommendation of the parliamentarian regarding the $15 an hour minimum wage. And I think that while that's an easy, I've heard a lot of different things about this. Let me express a point of view, which I think is a little bit different. I'm curious what people think about it. The parliamentarian is clearly the focus of attention right now. Right, because it's a person who made a ruling that's changing the course of what the administration would prefer to do. But if you take that away, I guess I would say that the question is whether or not the votes for a $15 minimum wage are there, whether the parliamentarian had said yes or no. And it's not clear to me that they are. I don't know that Joe Manchin, for example, has come out in support. Christian Sinema is another, very moderate Democrat who is against the filibuster, along with Manchin, openly against the filibuster. And so I think that the current administration's job in the Senate, given the fact that it's a tie, and given the fact that we saw bipartisan opposition to the COVID relief bill, I think that the administration has to walk this very difficult tightrope of maintaining that very thin balance. And those who are traditionalists or more inclined to be a traditionalist may exhibit some backlash towards the administration's goals if they disenfranchise institutions like the parliamentarian. And so while there's a lot of calling right now to ignore the parliamentarian and move forward. And I believe that the progressives and the liberals, including our own Representative Jayapal, who I dearly love, I think that they are inclined to have to make that point of view because that's what they stand for. But I also think that if you look at the balance of how decisions will be made in the Senate, it's not clear to me that ignoring the parliamentarian is the path that leaves us to greater ability to bring people together around the other legislation that has to be dealt with. So I'm just curious what people think about that. Lynn, you have your hand up.
I think you posed a really good question, and my comment is a question. I want to back up one step about what that parliamentarian rule was that has so upset people, because I think I heard it as a different and very understandable procedural objection to having within the COVID relief bill, which is just, you know, sending some money out to people to help them survive, the built-in agreement to have a $15 an hour wage hike. My understanding of the parliamentarian objection had to do with then people would be voting for two things at once, and that's not allowed. You know, we have that very problem here in Washington often where initiatives are thrown out because they have too many aspects in them, and it would not be clear who was voting for what. So is that the understanding of those of you who've also read about this particular dilemma about what happened with this parliamentarian rule? That's my understanding, that you can't have two things in one bill.
And if I can jump in, you have rules for reasons. You have speed limits for reasons. We on Vashon would have a bridge if it hadn't been for a parliamentary decision. It's easy to sort of trash the parliamentarian and see her as an opponent to progress. But at the same time, you've got rules and you work within the rules and you work to change the rules. And so it's not a dead end. I mean, the Senate can certainly act on, minimum wage. It's just, how are you going to do it? And how are you going to do it without changing the rules to the point where it becomes an unlimited speed anywhere,
My question is to anyone in our group here, what would it take to get rid of the filibuster? Because even more than this parliamentarian rule, the filibuster is a rule that allows the minority to absolutely stand in the way. And I do not think there's any point in waiting for, 10 Republicans or something that are going to change their minds. That just isn't going to happen in the Senate. So I want to see that. I want to see it dashed, and I want to see it dashed soon, and I want to see some progress forward.
It would take 51 votes, and it would take two senators who are currently opposed to change their minds. And there's a phone call campaigns to at least one of those senators from their constituents right now to try to make that happen. It would also take all the other senators who are hiding behind those two senators to make sure they're in support. And Bruce, did you have a comment?
Well, the filibuster rule has been removed in the past, so it's not impossible. And it is just a simple majority. Okay.
Yes.
Kevin,
okay. So we'll see where that takes us. Is our democracy. We're all keeping eyes open, but thank you so much for sharing views on where we stand as a democracy. I think we're seeing those Harbor Lights coming
on. And here they are, I hope.
That is usually covered by her phone.
Another wonderful version of the Brown Brief. Made an appearance. Thanks so much.
If you weren't staying at a Verbo Lake House.
You're together. Somehow we got the commercial. So let's, too bad we don't have Michael here. Shall we all sing Harbor Lights?
Please no.
So that's it for the Brown Briefly this week, folks. Thank you for listening.